Whatever happened to that daughter of his?
Colette?
Hell if I know.
After she had Rachel poisoned, we made sure to steer clear of her.
I wanted to press charges against her, you know, but Rachel wouldn't hear of it. Rachel sure is a forgiving person. That she is, and that's why I'm here. I'm under specific orders to come back and make peace with Amma. And is that what you want to do? Nick paused for a moment.
I'm not sure, quite honestly. Part of me feels like all this happened a lifetime ago. Our daily lives are so removed from everything going on here. On the one hand, I can't ever forget the way Rachel was treated and how my grandmother couldn't trust me. But on the other hand, her acceptance is kind of irrelevant now.
Everything ends up seeming irrelevant in the face of loss,
Colin said as he sped onto East Coast Parkway.
So am I taking you straight to the house? Or do you want to grab a bite first?
You know what? It's so late, I probably should go straight to the house. I'm sure there'll be food for us there. With everyone in town, I think Ah Ching's kitchen staff must be churning out food non-stop.
No problem. Tyersal Park. Coming right up. I'm just going to visualize 100 sticks of satay awaiting me there. You know, not to push you in any way, but I like your grandmother. She's always been good to me. Remember how I ran away from home after my step-monster threatened to ship me off to boarding school in Tasmania, and your grandma let us hide out in the treehouse at Tyersal Park?
Yeah. And every morning she would make the cook send a big basket full of breakfast goodies up to the tree, Nick added.
That's what I mean. All my associations with your grandma revolve around food. I'll never forget the chi chong fun and the char siu paos delivered on those bamboo trays and the freshly baked roti prata. We were feasting like kings up there. When I finally got sent home, I wanted to find any excuse I could to run away to that little tree house again. Our cook was nothing compared to yours.
Ha ha. I remember you ran away from home so many times.
Yep. My step-monster made life so miserable.
You only ran away once, if I remember correctly.
Nick nodded as the memory began to unfurl in his mind, taking him back to when he was 8 years old. They had been in the middle of dinner, just the three of them, his father, mother, and him eating in the breakfast room off the kitchen, as they did when his parents were an entertaining guest in the formal dining room. He could even remember what they ate that night. Bak kut teh. He had poured too much of the rich aromatic broth over his rice, making it too watery for his liking. But his mother had insisted he finish his bowl before she would let him redo it. She was more irritable than usual. It seemed like both his parents had been so tense for days now. Someone came speeding up the driveway too fast, and instead of parking by the front porch like all the guests would, the car kept going until it reached the back of the house, stopping just behind the garage. Nick looked out the window and saw Auntie Audrey, his parents' good friend, emerging from her Honda Prelude. He liked Auntie Audrey. She always made the most delicious nonya kueh. Was she bringing something yummy for dessert tonight? She came bursting through the back door, and Nick saw immediately that Auntie Audrey's face was puffy and bruised, her lip bleeding. The sleeve from her blouse was torn, and she looked totally dazed.
Alamak, Audrey! What happened?
His mother gasped as several maids came rushing into the room. Audrey ignored her, staring instead at his father, Philip.
Look what my husband did to me. I wanted you to see what the monster did to me.
His mother rushed to Auntie Audrey's side.
Desmond did this? Oh, my dear.
Don't touch me!
Audrey cried out as she crumpled to the floor. His father stood up from the table.
Nikki, upstairs now!
But Dad,
now!
His father shouted. Ling Jie rushed to Nick's side and steered him out of the dining room.
What is happening? Is Auntie Audrey okay?
Nick asked worriedly.
Don't worry about her. Let's go to your room. I'll play dominoes with you,
his nanny replied in her soothing Cantonese as she rushed him up the stairs. They sat there in his bedroom for about 15 minutes. Ling Jie had laid out the dominoes, but he was too distracted by the sounds coming from downstairs. He could hear muffled shouts and a woman weeping. Was it his mom or Auntie Audrey? He ran out to the landing and overheard Auntie Audrey shouting,
"Just because you're Youngs, you think you can go around fucking anyone you want?"
He couldn't believe his ears. He had never heard an adult use the F word like that.
What did this mean?
"Nikki, come back into the room at once,"
Ling Jie yelled, pulling him back into his bedroom. She shut the door tightly and began rushing around, hurriedly shutting the jealousy windows and turning on the air conditioner. Suddenly, the familiar tock-tock sound of an old taxi could be heard laboring up the steep driveway. Nick rushed to the veranda, and leaning out, he could see that it was Uncle Desmond, Auntie Audrey's husband, stumbling out of the taxi. His father came outside, and he could hear the both of them arguing in the dark, Uncle Desmond pleading,
"She's lying! It's all lies! I'm telling you!"
While his father murmured something and then suddenly forcefully raised his voice,
"Not in my house! Not in my house!"
At some point, he must have fallen asleep. He woke up not knowing what time it was. Ling Jie had left the room, and the air conditioner had been turned off, but the jealousy windows were still closed. It felt stiflingly hot. He cracked open the door carefully and saw across the hallway the line of light underneath the door to his parents' bedroom. Did he dare leave his room? Or would they be shouting at each other again? He didn't want to hear them fighting. He knew he wasn't supposed to hear them. He was feeling thirsty, so he walked out to the landing where there was a refrigerator that was always stocked with ice and a jug of water. As he opened the fridge and stood in front of it, feeling the cool draft against his body, he heard sobs coming from his parents' bedroom. Creeping over to their door, he could hear his mother suddenly scream,
"Don't you dare! Don't you dare! You'll see your name splashed over the front pages tomorrow!"
"Lower your voice!"
his father shouted back angrily.
"I'm going to ruin your precious name, I tell you! What I've had to put up with all these years from your family! I'm going to run. I'll run off with Nikki to America, and you'll never see him again. I'll kill you if you take my son!"
Nikki could feel his heart pounding. He had never heard his parents this angry before. He rushed into his bedroom, stripped off his pajamas, and threw on a t-shirt and his soccer shorts. He took out all the ang bao money he had saved in his little metal safe box, $790, and grabbed his silver flashlight, tucking it into the waistband of his shorts. He went out the door leading onto the veranda, where a large guava tree arched over the second floor. He grasped hold of one of the thick branches, swung onto the tree trunk, and quickly shimmied down to the ground, as he had done hundreds of times. Jumping onto his 10-speed bicycle, he raced out of the garage and down Tudor Close. He could hear the Alsatians at his neighbor's house begin to bark, and it made him cycle even faster. He sped down the long slope of Harlan Road until he reached Berrima Road. At the second house on the right, he stopped in front of the tall steel electronic gate and looked around. The concrete fence had glass spikes at the top, but he wondered whether he could still climb it, holding on to the edges and propelling himself quickly enough that he wouldn't get cut. He was still out of breath from his escape. A Malay guard came out of the sentry box next to the gate, astonished to see a boy standing there at 2 in the morning.
"What do you want, boy?"
It was the night guard who didn't know him.
"I need to see Colin. Can you tell him Nikki is here?"
The guard looked momentarily perplexed, but then he went into his sentry box and got on the phone. A few minutes later, Nick could see lights come on in the house, and the metal gate began to slide open with a quiet clang. As Nick walked down the driveway toward the house, the porch lights came on and the front door opened. Colin's British grandmother, Winifred Koo, who always reminded him of a plumper version of Margaret Thatcher, stood at the doorway in a quilted peach silk robe.
"Nicholas Young, is everything all right?"
He ran up to her and breathlessly blurted out,
"My parents are fighting. They want to kill each other, and my mother wants to take me away."
"Calm down, calm down. No one is going to take you away," Mrs. Koo said, soothingly, putting her arms around him. The tension that had been bottled up all evening came out, and he began sobbing uncontrollably. Half an hour later, as he sat on a bar stool in the upstairs library, enjoying a vanilla root beer float with Colin, Philip and Eleanor Young arrived at the Koo residence. He could hear their polite tones as they talked to Winifred Koo in the drawing room downstairs.
"Naturally, our boy overreacted. I think his imagination got away with him."
He could hear his mother laughing, speaking in that English accent of hers that she put on whenever she was talking to Westerners.
"All the same, I think he should probably just spend the night here," Winifred Koo said.
Just then, another car could be heard pulling up the front driveway. Colin turned on the television, which flickered a security camera screen that revealed a stately black Mercedes 600 Pullman limousine arriving at the front door. A tall, uniformed Gurkha jumped out and opened the passenger door.
"It's your ama,"
Colin said excitedly, as the boys rushed to the banister to peek at what was going on downstairs. Sue E. entered the house, with two Thai lady maids trailing behind her, and Nick's nanny, Ling Jie, suddenly also appeared, clutching three big boxes of mooncakes. Nick figured that Ling Jie must have alerted his grandmother to what had happened at his house. Even though she now worked for his parents, her ultimate loyalty was always to Sue E. Sue E., wearing her trademark tinted glasses, was dressed in a chic rose-colored linen pantsuit with a ruffled high-neck blouse, looking as if she had just come from addressing the UN General Assembly.
"I must apologize for inconveniencing you like this," he heard his grandmother say to Winifred Koo in perfect English.
Nick had no idea his grandmother could speak English so well. He saw his parents standing off to the side with stunned, chastened looks on their faces. Ling Jie handed Winifred the towering stack of square tin boxes.
"My goodness, the famous mooncakes from Tyersal Park!
This is much too generous of you,"
Winifred said.
"Not at all. I am so appreciative of your calling me."
"Now where's Nicky?" his grandmother asked. Nick and Colin ran back into the library, pretending they had heard nothing until they were summoned downstairs by Colin's nanny.
"Nicky, there you are,"
his grandmother said. She put her hand on his shoulder and said, "Now say thank you to Mrs. Koo."
"Thanks, Mrs. Koo. Good night, Colin," he said with a grin, as his grandmother guided him out the front door and into the Mercedes.
She climbed in after him, and Ling Jie also got in, sitting on the folding seat in the middle row of the stretch limousine with the Thai ladies' maids. As the car door was about to shut, his father came rushing out.
"Mummy, are you taking Nicky to Wah Mai Chap?"
Hokkien for "I couldn't give a damn." Sue said sharply in Hokkien, turning away from her son as the guard shut the door firmly. As the car pulled out of the Koo residence, he asked his grandmother in Cantonese,
"Are we going to your house?"
"Yes, I'm taking you to Tyersal Park."
"How long can I stay there?"
"For as long as you want."
"Will Dad and Mom come to see me?"
"Only if they can learn to behave themselves," Sui replied. His grandmother reached her arm out, drawing him closer, and he remembered being surprised by the gesture, by the softness of her body as he leaned against her while the car rocked gently back and forth as it navigated down the dark, leafy lanes. And now in a flash, Nick found himself on that same dark lane again, more than two decades later, with Colin at the wheel of his Porsche. As the car wound along Tyersal Avenue, Nick felt like he knew every curve and bump of the road. The sudden dip that put them eye level with the gnarled, ancient tree trunks. The dense overhang of foliage that kept it cool even on the hottest day. He must have walked or cycled down this narrow lane 1,000 times as a kid. He realized for the first time that he was excited to be home again, and that the hurt he had felt over the past few years was fading. Without quite realizing it, he had already forgiven his grandmother. The car pulled up to the familiar gates of Tyersall Park, and Colin breezily announced to the approaching guard, "I'm delivering Nicholas Young." The yellow-turbaned Gurkha peered in the front window of the car at the both of them and said, "I'm sorry, but we're not expecting any more visitors tonight." "We're not visitors. This is Nicholas Young right here. This is his grandmother's house," Colin insisted. Nick leaned toward the driver's seat, trying to get a better look at the guard. He didn't recognize the man. He must have started working for Tyersall Park after his last visit.
"Hey!
I don't think we've met before. I'm Nick. They are expecting my arrival up at the house."
The guard turned around and went back into the guardhouse for a moment. He returned with a brown paper log and began flipping through the pages. Colin turned to Nick and snickered in disbelief.
"Can you believe this? I'm sorry, but I don't see either of your names here, and we are under high alert at the moment. I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to turn around."
"Look, is Vikram here? Can you please call Vikram?"
Nick asked, beginning to lose his patience. Vikram, who headed the guard unit for the past 2 decades, would quickly put an end to this absurdity.
"Captain Gale is off duty right now. He returns at 8 tomorrow morning."
"Well, call him. Or call whoever the on-duty supervisor is."
"That would be Sergeant Gurung,"
the guard said, getting out his walkie-talkie. He began talking in Nepali into the device, and a few minutes later, an officer emerged from the darkness, having come from the main guardhouse up the road. Nick recognized him immediately.
"Hey, Joey! It's me, Nick! Will you tell your friend here to let us through?"
The burly guard in the starched olive fatigues walked up to the passenger side window with a big smile.
"Nicky Young, it's so good to see you. What has it been? 4, 5 years now?"
"I was lost back in 2010. That's why your compadre over here doesn't know me."
Sergeant Gurung leaned against the car window. "Listen, we are under specific orders here. I don't quite know how to put this, but we're not allowed to let you enter." Chapter 13. Tyersall Park, Singapore. 24 hours earlier. 3, 4, 5, Eddie counted as he stood by the window in the upstairs foyer, looking down the driveway. There were 5 cars in the motorcade. 4, really, if you didn't count the minivan transporting all the maids bringing up the rear. Auntie Catherine and her family had just flown in from Bangkok, and Eddie was surprised there were so few cars in their convoy. In the lead was a white Mercedes S-Class with diplomatic license plates, obviously provided by the Thai embassy. But the other cars were a random assortment. A BMW X5 SUV behind the Benz, an Audi that looked at least 5 years old, and that last car, he didn't even have a clue what it was. It was some non-European 4-door sedan, something that didn't register on his list of acceptable vehicles to be seen in. Yesterday, when he had arrived with his family from Hong Kong, his executive assistant, Stella, had arranged a fleet of 6 matching Carpathian Grey Range Rovers, making for an impressive entrance as the Ching Femia pulled up to the front door of Tyersall Park. Today, he felt almost embarrassed for Auntie Catherine and her clan. Her husband, M.C. Taksin Akara. M.C. is an abbreviation for Mom Jiao, which translates to Serene Highness, and is the title reserved for the grandchildren of the King of Thailand. Since King Chulalongkorn, 1853 to 1910, had 97 children by 36 wives, and King Mongkut, 1804 to 1868, had 82 children by 39 wives. There are several hundred people still alive who can use the title of Mom Jiao. Was one of the descendants of King Mongkut, and Eddie remembered every detail of his last visit to Thailand when he was 19 as if it was yesterday. The sprawling compound of historic villas set in a garden paradise on the banks of the Chao Phraya River, the way his cousins James, Matt, and Adam had three servants each that would prostrate at their feet as if they were little gods, ready to attend to their every whim. The fleet of forest green BMWs idling in the front courtyard, ready to take them to the polo club, the tennis club, or any of Sukhumvit's hottest dance clubs. And Jessie Ann, that sexy cousin of theirs who went down on him in the upstairs toilet of a pizza parlor in Hua Hin one night. So why were the Akaras pulling up in such a ragtag bunch of cars? And wait a minute, what the hell was happening outside? Sanjit, the butler, and the entire household staff, including the Gurkha guards, were all dressed in their crisp uniforms and assembling along the front driveway. And Aling and Auntie Victoria were also part of the greeting party. Fucky fuck. Why hadn't they done this for his family when they arrived yesterday? Eddie was annoyed to see that his parents had gone outside too, and he was determined that he would under no circumstances join them. Thank goodness Fiona had taken the kids to the zoo. Otherwise, they would surely want to be part of this idiocy and make the Akaras feel like they were truly hot shit. He ducked out of view and hid in the service hallway, waiting for everyone to come upstairs, knowing it was always the custom at Tyersal Park for guests to be served iced longan tea in the drawing room when they first arrived. Two waiters passed by, rolling cocktail trolleys filled with glassware and large silver samovars of tea, mystified by Eddie lurking in the hallway. He glared at them and hissed, "You didn't see me. I'm not here." When Eddie began to hear voices coming up the stairs, he ambled into the drawing room with his hands nonchalantly tucked into the pockets of his salmon-colored Rubinacci trousers. Auntie Cat was the first to arrive at the top of the grand staircase, chattering away excitedly with his mother in that distinctive convent schoolgirl lilt of hers. Catherine Young Akara, like many of the girls of her generation and social standing, attended the Convent of the Holy Infant Jesus Girls' School in Singapore, where they were taught by British nuns and developed the curious distinctive accents that made them all sound like extras in BBC period dramas.
"What a surprise to see you and Malcolm up front. I thought you weren't arriving until this evening."
"That was the plan, but Eddie managed to fly all of us down on a private jet yesterday."
"Wah, come home, Ang."
Cantonese for, "Wow, what a good life." Catherine remarked as a waiter approached them bearing a silver tray filled with tall glasses of iced longan tea. Eddie studied his aunt for a moment as she sat down on a divan next to his mother, marveling at how different the sisters looked. Auntie Cat's stocky, athletic physique was enviable for a woman in her 70s, and in such contrast to his other aunties with their bony, aristocratically malnourished frames. Unfortunately, she did take after her sisters in her fashion sense. On a charitable day, Eddie might have politely described her style as eccentric. Today, she just looked god-awful in that boxy purple silk pantsuit, obviously tailor-made and obviously several decades old, mud-colored Clark's open-toed walking sandals, and the same pair of Sophia Loren bluish-tinted bifocals he had seen her wear for decades. Catching sight of him, Catherine exclaimed,
"My goodness, Eddie, I hardly recognized you. You look like you've lost a bit of weight." "Thank you for noticing, Auntie Cat."
"Yes, I've lost about 20 pounds in the past year."
"Good for you! And your mother tells me you flew the whole family down yesterday?"
"Well, I was attending the World Economic Forum in Davos as an official delegate, and my client, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, you know, one of Russia's richest men, insisted that I borrow his Boeing business jet when he heard about Amar's heart attack. And you know, it's such a huge plane. I thought it was a pity that I was the only passenger. So instead of flying straight to Singapore, we made a detour to Hong Kong so I could pick up the whole family.
Catherine turned to her sister.
You see, Alex, I don't know what you keep complaining about. Your son is so thoughtful.
Yes, very thoughtful, Alex added, trying to block out the memory of Eddie screaming at her over the phone yesterday. You have 2 hours to get everyone to Hong Kong Airport or I'm leaving without you. My special friend is doing us a very special favor by lending us his very special plane, you know. And for God's sake, please pack some decent clothes and jewelry this time. I don't want you to be mistaken for a mainland tourist when I'm with you in Singapore. Last time, we got such bad service at Crystal Jade Palace because of the way you looked.
How did you all fly down?
Eddie asked, wondering what kind of private jet the Akaras had these days.
Well, Thai Airways was running a special just for today. If you buy 3 economy tickets, the 4th person flies for free. So it was quite a savings for our whole lot.
But then, when we got to the airport and they realized it was your Uncle Tuxin, they upgraded us to first class.
Eddie couldn't believe his ears. The Akaras never flew commercial. Not since Uncle Tuxin had become a special attaché to the Thai Air Force back in the 1970s. Just then, Eddie spied his uncle entering the drawing room alongside his father. It had been years since he had last seen his uncle, but he appeared not to have aged one bit. He was older than his father, but looked about a decade younger. His perpetually tan face was wrinkle-free, and he still had that ramrod straight posture and robust gait of a man accustomed to seeing and being seen. If only his dad wasn't getting so stooped, and if only he dressed more like Uncle Tuxin. Eddie had always admired his uncle's dapper style, and on visits to Bangkok during his teens, he made a point of sneaking into his uncle's closet and checking out all the labels on his clothes. No small feat when there were so many pesky servants lurking everywhere. Today, Uncle Tuxin was decked out in an impeccably tailored pale orange dress shirt. Judging from the Sea Island cotton, it was most likely Aid and Ravenscroft, worn with a pair of navy blue chinos and a highly polished pair of monk strap loafers. Were they Garziano and Girling or Edward Green? He would have to ask him later. And most important, what watch was Uncle Tuxin sporting today? He glanced at his sleeve cuff, expecting to see a Patek, Vacheron, or Breguet, but was horrified to see an Apple Watch strapped to his wrist. Dear God, how the mighty had fallen! Behind Tuxin came his son Adam, whom Eddie didn't know all that well because he was more than a decade younger. The baby of the family, Adam was slightly built and had delicately chiseled, almost feline features. He looked like one of those Thai pop idols and seemed to dress the part in his skinny jeans and a vintage Hawaiian shirt. Eddie was not impressed. But wait a minute. Who was the sexy thing that he would definitely swipe right for? Sauntering up the stairs was a girl with alabaster skin and waist-length black hair. Here at last was someone with style. The girl was wearing a sleeveless ice blue Amelia Wickstead jumpsuit, blue suede ankle boots, and casually slung on her shoulder was the sort of handbag that Eddie was sure had a 3-year waiting list. This must be Adam's new wife, Princess Pia, whom his mother couldn't stop gushing about after she attended their wedding last year. To his eternal chagrin, Eddie had not been invited to his cousin's wedding to M.R. Pia Rasami Apishapong. Only his parents had been invited to the small, intimate destination wedding held at a private villa in the Similan Islands.
Uncle Tuxin, so good to see you. And Adam, long time no see.
Eddie patted his cousin on the back enthusiastically. Adam turned to his wife and said, "This is Auntie Alex's eldest son, Eddie, who also lives in Hong Kong."
"Princess Pia, it is an honor to meet you."
Bending forward, Eddie grasped her hand and bowed to give it a kiss. Adam snorted almost imperceptibly, while Pia burst into giggles at Eddie's ridiculously overblown gesture.
"Please,
It's just Pia. Only the children and grandchildren of the king use any sort of formal titles. I'm just a distant relation.
I do believe you're being very modest. I mean, you've been given the pearl suite.
What's that? Pia asked. Before Eddie could answer, Adam cut in. It's this bedroom where all the walls are inlaid with mother of pearl. Really remarkable.
Yes, it's this vast suite of rooms, perfect for families, really. My wife and three children usually stay in there when we visit.
Eddie couldn't help adding. Which room are you in now? Adam asked.
We're in the yellow room. It's very cozy.
Pia's brow furrowed. Adam, this doesn't sound right to me. We must move into another bedroom so Eddie and his family can have this larger suite.
But you're our honored royal guest. You must have the pearl suite. I didn't mean to imply anything with my comment. Constantine, Augustine, and Callist are having loads of fun sharing the same bed. And Fiona even managed to get 3 hours of sleep last night.
Oh, dear, I wouldn't feel comfortable in the pearl suite knowing that. Adam, could you take care of this? Pia insisted. Of course, I'll have a word with Aling the minute I see her, Adam replied. Eddie smiled graciously.
You are both too kind. Now where are your brothers? I thought the whole family was coming today. There's an 18-wheeler full of seafood awaiting them.
Adam gave him a puzzled look. Pia and I were the only ones who came down with Mum and Dad. Jimmy, as you know, is a doctor, so he can't get away from work so easily. And Maddie is on a skiing trip with his family in Verbier.
Ah! I was just in Switzerland, too. I was at Davos as an official delegate at the World Economic Forum.
Oh, I was at Davos 2 years ago, Pia said.
Really? What were you doing there?
I was giving a talk to Igwell. Eddie looked momentarily stunned as Adam proudly explained. Pia's a virologist based at WHO in Bangkok. The World Health Organization is a specialized agency of the United Nations that deals with international public health issues. The Southeast Asia Regional Office is located in Bangkok.
She specializes in mosquito-borne viruses like malaria and dengue fever, and she's become one of the leading authorities on tropical diseases.
Pia smiled bashfully.
Oh, Adam's exaggerating. I'm no authority. I'm just part of the team. Now that man over there looks like he's an authority.
Eddie turned to see Professor Un, still in his surgical scrubs, enter the drawing room. Catherine got up from her divan and rushed up to him.
Francis, so good to see you. How is Mummy today?
Her vitals are stable at the moment.
Can we go in and see her now?
She's in and out of consciousness. I will let 4 visitors in, but 2 at a time, and only for 5 minutes each.
Alex looked at her sister.
Go on. Take Thaksin, Adam, and Pia with you. I've already spent time with her this morning.
I haven't seen Amma yet today, Eddie cut in.
Dr. Un, surely one more visitor won't make any difference.
Okay, I'll let you go in for a few minutes after the rest have come out, but only for a few minutes. We don't want to add any more strain to her today, the doctor said.
Of course.
I won't say a word.
Eddie, will you say a little prayer for Amma when you're in the room with her?
Auntie Victoria suddenly asked.
Sure. I can do that,
Eddie promised. The 5 of them headed down the corridor to Sui's private quarters. The sitting room adjoining her bedroom had been transformed into a cardiac care unit, with half the room turned into a clinical prep area and the other half filled with various medical machines. Several doctors and nurses huddled over a bank of computer screens, analyzing every blip in their VVIP patients' vital signs, while Sui's Thai ladies' maids hovered just by the doorway, ready to spring into action should their mistress bat an eyelash. The minute they saw Prince Thaksin approach, they dropped to the floor, prostrating themselves. Eddie felt his gut tighten in a mixture of awe and envy as he noticed that his aunt and uncle walked right past the ladies, not even noticing the gesture.
Fucky fuck! Why couldn't he have been born into that family?
While Catherine and Thaksin went into Sui's bedroom, Eddie waited in the hallway with Adam and Pia. Taking the seat next to Pia, on a velvet rule-man settee, he whispered.
So, I take it you had an Igwell badge?
Pia was momentarily confused. I'm sorry, are you referring to Davos?
Yes, when you were at Davos 2 years ago. What kind of badge did they give you? The white one with the blue line at the bottom, or the plain white one with the hologram sticker?
I'm afraid I can't remember what it looked like.
What did you do with it?
I wore it, Pia replied patiently, wondering why on earth her husband's cousin was so weirdly fixated on this badge.
I mean, what did you do with your badge after the conference?
I must have either thrown it away or left it in the hotel room.
Eddie stared at her in disbelief. His Davos badge was folded and placed in a special pouch, along with his prized Roger W. Smith watch.
One of the most sought-after bespoke watches in the world. Each Roger W. Smith watch is made by hand, takes 11 months to complete, and there's a 4-year waiting list for one, probably 5 years after this is published. And his precious sapphire and platinum cufflinks. He couldn't wait to get it framed the minute he returned to Hong Kong. He was quiet for a few moments before turning his attention to Adam.
So what are you up to these days? Do you work, or do you just live a life of leisure?
Adam felt like grimacing, but he was too well brought up to show any reaction. Why did so many people assume that just because he had a royal title, he didn't have to work for a living?
I'm an F&B.
An abbreviation for food and beverage. Currently one of the hottest industries in Asia. All the CRAs that used to work in M&A want to get into F&B these days.
I have a restaurant at Central Embassy, which is the newest mall in town. And I also have a few gourmet food trucks that serve authentic Austrian Wurstelstand snacks like Bratwurst, Currywurst, and Käsekreiner. You know, those Austrian sausages filled with cheese? A sausage truck? You actually make a profit from that? Eddie asked.
We do quite well. We park the trucks in all the nightlife spots around the city. People love to get a snack late at night after they leave the bars and clubs.
The sausages help to soak up the alcohol, Pia added.
Drunk people snacks. How lucrative,
Eddie said with a not-so-subtle hint of condescension.
He sat waiting for Adam or Pia to ask him what he did for a living when his aunt and uncle came out of the bedroom.
She's asleep, but you can go in, Catherine said to her son.
Catherine sank down on the settee next to Eddie, suddenly looking totally deflated.
How is she today? Eddie asked.
Hard to tell. Francis said that with the morphine drip, she wasn't in any pain. I've just never seen her look so frail, Catherine said, her voice cracking a little.
Tuxin placed a comforting hand on her shoulder as she continued to talk.
I should have come down in November like I meant to. And the boys, why didn't we make them come down more often?
Auntie Cat, you should go to your room and rest for a little while, Eddie suggested in a gentle tone. He became uncomfortable whenever women got emotional around him.
Yes, I think that's a good idea, Catherine said, getting up from the settee.
I'm going to call Jimmy and Matty. We'll get them to fly over immediately. There's not a moment to waste, Tuxin said to her as they walked off.
Not a moment to waste, Eddie thought to himself. But Auntie Cat had done nothing but waste her time. She had spent so many decades away, and his cousins hardly knew their grandmother. And now that Ama was dying, they were finally going to show their faces? It was too little too late. Or could there be another motive behind all this? Were the Akaris tight on money these days? Was this why they came down on a commercial flight? He couldn't imagine the humiliation. A Thai prince flying in economy class, and they only brought 5 maids with them this time. And Adam had to run these pathetic little hot dog trucks. It was all beginning to make sense. Was Uncle Tuxin urgently summoning all his sons to Singapore so they get their hands on Tyersal Park? Everyone knew that Nicky had been disinherited and that Ama would never leave any of the Leong cousins Tyersal Park when they already owned most of Malaysia. The only contenders left were the Akara boys, his brother Alistair, and him. Ama had never thought much of Alistair,
especially after he tried to bring Kitty Pong home. But the Akaras, she always had a soft spot for them because they were half Thai. She loved her Thai food and her Thai silks and her creepy Thai maids, everything from that goddamn country. But he wasn't going to let those Akaras win. They lived their lavish, snotty royal lives and only deigned to come for short visits every 3 or 4 years, while he made a point of visiting his grandmother at least once a year. Yes, he was the only one who deserved the deed to Tiesel Park. Adam and Pia emerged from the bedroom, and Eddie immediately went in. There wasn't a moment of his time to waste. Sue-Yi's canopied bed, with its ornately carved Art Nouveau headboard, had been replaced by one of those state-of-the-art hospital beds with an electronic mattress that constantly shifted the patient's body weight to prevent bed sores. Aside from the oxygen tube at her nose and a few tubes coming out of various veins on her arms, she looked so serene lying there under her sumptuous lotus silk bedsheets. A heart monitor on a stand pulsed quietly by her side, its screen displaying her ever-changing heart rate. Eddie stood at the foot of the bed, wondering whether he should say a little prayer or something. It seemed slightly absurd since he really didn't believe in God, but he did promise Auntie Victoria. He kneeled down beside his grandmother, folded his hands, and just as he closed his eyes, he heard a sharp voice say in Cantonese, "Ni zuo me ye?" "What on earth are you doing?" Eddie opened his eyes and saw his grandmother staring at him. Ama, you're finally awake. I was about to say a prayer for you. Ni qi si na? Cantonese for, have you lost your mind? Don't you start on me. I'm so sick of all these people trying to pray for me. Victoria kept sending that Bishop Si Beixian to drone his idiotic prayers every morning when I was at the hospital. And I was too weak to chase him out at the time. Eddie laughed. If you want, I can make sure Bishop C isn't allowed to see you ever again. Please. Were you awake when Adam and Pia came in?
No. Adam is here?
Yes, and he brought his wife. She's pretty, in that Thai sort of way.
How about his brothers?
No, they aren't here. I'm told Jimmy is much too busy working to come down. I guess since he's a plastic surgeon, there are too many urgent facelifts and nose jobs that require his attention right now.
Sue-Yi smiled slightly at Eddie's comment.
And do you know what Maddie is doing?
Tell me.
He's on holiday with his family, skiing in Switzerland. Can you imagine? I happen to be in Switzerland too, attending a very important conference with the world's most important businessmen, political leaders, and Pharrell. But I dropped everything and flew straight to Singapore the minute I heard you were ill.
Eddie looked up at her heart monitor and saw that it was accelerating from 80 to 95 beats per minute. Sue-Yi let out a brief sigh.
Who else is here?
Our whole family came down from Hong Kong, even Cecilia and Alistair.
Where are they?
Everyone's at the zoo right now. Fiona, Constantine, Augustine, Callist, Cecilia and Jake. Artok got them special VIP tickets for that river safari thing, but they will be back by tea time. Uncle Alfred gets in later tonight, and, I'm told that Nikki is arriving tomorrow.
Nikki? Coming from New York?
Sue-Yi muttered.
Yes, that's what I hear.
Sue-Yi remained silent, and Eddie observed that the heart rate number on her monitor was rising rapidly. 100, 105, 110 beats per minute.
You don't want to see him, do you?
Eddie asked. Sue-Yi simply closed her eyes, a lone tear streaming down the side of her face. Eddie glanced uneasily at the monitor. 120, 130.
I don't blame you, Ama. Showing up here like this now, after all he's done to betray your wishes.
No, no.
Sue-Yi finally said. Her heart rate suddenly jumped to 145 beats per minute, and Eddie looked at her in alarm.
When the number hit 150, the heart monitor began emitting a high-pitched beep,
and Professor Un rushed into the room along with another doctor.
"She's elevating too rapidly," one of the doctors said in alarm. "Should we defibrillate?"
"No, no, I'm going to give her a slow bolus of digoxin. Eddie, please clear the room," Professor Un ordered as two nurses rushed in to assist.
Eddie backed out just as his Aunt Victoria entered the sitting room.
"Is everything okay?"
"Don't go in now. I think Amma's having another heart attack. I mentioned Nikki, and she began to freak out."
Victoria moaned.
"Why on earth did you mention Nikki?"
"She wanted to know who was here and who was coming."
"I can tell you one thing, though.
Amma does not wish to see Nikki. She does not even want him to set foot in this house. It was the last thing she told me."
Chapter 14. Jodhpur, India. Astrid stood on the balcony, breathing in the luxuriant scent that wafted up from the rose gardens below. From her vantage point at the Umaid Bawan Palace Hotel, she had a sweeping view of the city. To the east, an impossibly romantic-looking fort, perched on a mountain top, while in the distance, the tight clusters of vibrant blue buildings that made up the medieval city of Jodhpur gleamed in the early morning light. The blue city, Astrid thought to herself. She had heard somewhere that all the houses here were painted this shade of cobalt because it was believed to ward off evil spirits. The color reminded her of Yves Saint Laurent and Pierre Berger's estate in Marrakech. The Majorelle Gardens, much of which was also painted a distinctive shade of blue, the only house in an entire city of rose ochre allowed by decree of the king to be painted a different color. Astrid stretched out on the chaise lounge and poured herself another cup of chai from the silver Art Deco teapot. This monumental palace had been commissioned by the present Maharaja's grandfather in 1929 to give work to all the people during a great famine, so every detail retained its original Art Deco style, from the pink sandstone pillars in the rotunda to the blue mosaic tiles in the underground swimming pool built so that the Maharani could swim in complete privacy. The place reminded her a bit of Tyersal Park, and for a moment, Astrid felt an intense pang of guilt. Her grandmother lay in bed, attended by a team of doctors, while she was here, enjoying a secret weekend rendezvous at a palace. Her guilt faded slightly as she caught sight of Charlie padding out onto the balcony, clad only in his drawstring pajama trousers. When did he become so built? Back in their university days in London, Charlie had been positively scrawny, but now his lanky torso took on that distinctive V-shape, and his abs looked more ripped than she had ever remembered. He stood beside her as she lay on the chaise lounge, bending over and kissing that tender spot on her neck.
"Morning, gorgeous."
"Good morning. Did you sleep well?"
"Now I don't recall getting any sleep last night, but I'm sure glad you did," Charlie teased, as he poured a cup of coffee from the samovar setup on the chrome and glass trolley. He took his first sip and murmured in satisfaction.
"Mmm, how great is this coffee?" Astrid smiled placidly.
"Actually, I'm sure their coffee is great, but I brought these beans. I know how much you love your first cup, so I had them ground for you this morning. It's Ethiopian Yirgacheffe from Verve Coffee in L.A.
Charlie gazed at her in appreciation. "That's it. I'm kidnapping you and not letting you go back to Singapore. I'm never going to let you leave my side for, well, the rest of eternity."
"Kidnap me all you want, but you'll have to contend with my family. I'm sure my dad will send out a SWAT team if I don't turn up for breakfast at Nassim Road on Monday morning. Don't worry, I'll get you back in time. And you can even show up with a big tray of these pratas for breakfast," Charlie said, taking a bite out of the buttery, still warm Indian layered bread.
Astrid giggled.
"No, no, it has to be something Malay. Otherwise they'll suspect."
"It feels like I'm playing hooky, but I'm so glad you convinced me to do this. I really needed it."
"You've been spending so much time at your grandmother's bedside, dealing with the family circus.
I thought you could use a break. Charlie perched on the balcony's edge, looking down at an ornately turbaned man sitting on a pile of pillows in the middle of the grand terrace, playing a soft melody on his bansuri while a flock of peacocks wandered behind him on the great lawn.
Astrid, you need to come check this out. There's a flute player on the terrace, surrounded by peacocks.
I saw him. He's been out there all morning. It's absolute heaven here, isn't it?
Astrid closed her eyes for a moment, listening to the enchanting melody as she savored the warmth of the sun on her face.
Well, just wait. We haven't even toured the city yet,
Charlie said with a sly gleam in his eyes. Astrid smiled to herself, enjoying his impish little boy expression.
What was Charlie up to? He looked just like Cassian did whenever he was trying to hide a secret.
After they had enjoyed a classic Indian breakfast of akuri-spiced scrambled eggs on lacha prata, chicken samosas, and fresh mango pudding on their private balcony, Charlie and Astrid walked to the front entrance to the palace. As they waited for the Maharaja's Rolls-Royce Phantom II to pull up to the front steps, the guards started showering compliments on Astrid.
"Ma'am, we've never seen anyone look so beautiful in Jodhpurs," they praised.
Astrid smiled bashfully. She was wearing a white linen tunic tucked into the new pair of white Jodhpurs that had just been tailored for her. But instead of a belt, she had wound a long hand-beaded Scott Diffriant turquoise necklace through the belt loops. They were driven in the vintage convertible to the Miranga Fort, an imposing red sandstone fortress perched on a dramatic cliff 400 feet above the skyline of Jodhpur. At the foot of the hill, they transferred into a small jeep that sped them up to the steep road to the main entrance. A beautiful arched gateway flanked by ancient frescoes known as Jaipal, the Gate of Victory. Soon, they were strolling hand in hand through the interconnected network of palaces and museums that made up the fort complex, marveling at the intricately carved walls and expansive courtyards that afforded commanding views of the city.
"This is incredible," Astrid said in a hushed voice as they entered an elaborate chamber where the walls and ceilings were made entirely of mirrored glass mosaic tiles.
"Well, they don't call this the most beautiful fort in Rajasthan for nothing," Charlie said. As they strolled through a reception hall, where every surface, from the walls to the ceilings to the floors, was painted in dizzyingly colorful floral patterns, Astrid couldn't help but comment.
"It's so empty. Where are all the tourists?"
"The fort's actually closed today, but Shivraj had the place open just for us."
"How sweet of him. So this fort belongs to his family?"
"Since the 15th century. It's one of the only forts in India that's still controlled by the original ruling family that built it."
"Am I going to get the chance to thank Shivraj in person?"
"Oh, I forgot to tell you. We've been invited to the private residence at Umaid Bawan for dinner tonight with his family."
"Great. I wonder if they are related to the Singhs. You know, Gayatri Singh?
Our family friend who throws those fabulous parties where she displays all her jewels?"
"Her father was a Maharaja of one of the Indian states, although I can't recall which one at the moment."
"Maybe. I think many of the royal families of India intermarried," Charlie replied a little distractedly.
"Are you okay?"
Astrid asked, noticing his change of mood.
Yeah, I'm fine. There's this amazing room that I'm trying to find for you. I know you'll love it. I think it's up these stairs."
Charlie led her up a steep staircase that wound around in a teardrop shape, and at the top of the stairwell, they arrived at the long, narrow room flanked by arch windows along every wall. In the middle of the room was a collection of golden baby cradles, each more ornate than the other.
"Is this the nursery?"
Astrid asked.
"No, this is actually part of the zenana, where the ladies of the palace were cloistered. This building is called the Peeping Palace, because the ladies would come here and peep down on the activities of the courtyard below."
"Oh, that's right. The royal wives and concubines could never be seen by the public, could they?"
Astrid leaned out a window framed by a distinctive Bengali-style eave, peeking through the little star-patterned holes in the screened window. Then she opened the shutters completely, taking in the view below of the grand marbled courtyard, surrounded on three sides by palace balconies.
"Hey, do you want to get your hands painted with henna?" Charlie asked.
"Oh, I'd love to. The concierge at the hotel told me there's a henna artist here who does the most incredible work. I think she's in the museum gift shop. Let me go get her."
"I'll come with you."
No, stay here and enjoy the incredible view. I'll get her and be right back."
"Oh, okay,"
Astrid said, a little puzzled as Charlie rushed off. She sat on a bench in the room, contemplating what it would have been like to be married to a Maharaja back in the time when they were absolute rulers of their kingdoms. It would have been a life of unfathomable luxury, but she wasn't sure she wanted to be part of a harem with dozens of queens and concubines. How could she ever share the man she loved with someone else?
And were the women ever allowed to wander beyond the palace walls, or even to step onto the elegant courtyard below? Astrid heard some laughter in the distance, and she spied several women emerging through an arched doorway in the courtyard. How pretty they looked in their red and white lehenga cholis. They were followed by another row of women in the same tightly cropped blouses and flowing embroidered skirts, and soon there were about a dozen of them in the courtyard. The women walked single file in a circle as the sound of drumming began to emanate from deep within the fort. Suddenly, the women formed a straight line right below where Astrid was standing. They flung their hands in the air, jerked their heads up at her, and began stomping their feet in rhythm to the drumming. From the archways on the lower floor beneath where Astrid was standing, a dozen men in white came running out between the women to the far side of the courtyard. A Hindi pop song began blasting through the air, and the men and women danced opposite each other in a seductive face-off. They were soon joined by another dozen female dancers in vibrant blue and purple saris, streaming in from the north and south gates of the courtyard as the music got louder and louder. Suddenly, the song stopped abruptly, and the window shutters on the opposite side of the courtyard flung open, revealing a man in a gold-embroidered shawani. He extended his arms toward Astrid, singing a cappella in Hindi. Then the music resumed as the dancers continued to stomp and twirl.
Astrid burst out laughing, delighted at the Bollywood spectacle unfolding before her. "Charlie must be behind all this. No wonder he's been acting weird ever since we got here," she thought.
The man disappeared from the turret, only to appear moments later in the courtyard leading a band of musicians. The entire troupe danced to the beat of the music, moving in perfect formation. She looked down at the handsome lead singer outfitted in gold, realizing with a shock that it was none other than Shah Rukh Khan, one of India's biggest stars. Before she could even react properly, the sound of trumpets filled the air, followed by a strange roaring sound. Turning to the main archway into the courtyard, Astrid's eyes widened in surprise. Coming through the gate was an elephant, festooned with gemstones and vibrant pink and yellow patterns painted onto its head, being led by two mahouts dressed in the full regalia of the royal court of Jodhpur. On the elephant's back was an ornate silver howdah, and perched majestically on one of its seats, dressed in a midnight blue paisley shawani with matching trousers and turban, was Charlie. Astrid's jaw dropped, and she ran out of the room onto the open veranda. "Charlie, what's all this?" The elephant strode over to her veranda, and she was almost at eye level with Charlie as he sat on top of the elephant. The mahouts guided the elephant so that it stood alongside the balcony, and Charlie leapt off the howdah onto the terrace where Astrid stood. "I wanted this to be a surprise. I haven't wanted to tell you until now, but Isabel signed our divorce papers last week." Astrid let out a little gasp. "Yes. I'm a free man, completely free, and I realize that in all the craziness of the past few years, we've just talked about getting married as though it was a done deal, but you know, I never properly proposed to you."
Charlie suddenly got down on one knee and stared up at her. Astrid, you are and have always been the love of my life. My angel, my savior. I don't know what I'd do without you.